All of us have healing work to do on race and culture topics. We have those questions that seem to be unaskable in today's climate. Now, we have a forum where we can ask experts, listen, and share. Welcome to A Safe Place to Talk About Race with your host, Sharon E. Davis. Get ready to engage and add your voice to racial healing in the next hour. Let's start right now. Here's Sharon E. Davis.
Oh, welcome to our show. We're so delighted that you're able to join us again and to participate in the healing of racism. You know, if you would like to send us an email or call in, this is what you need to do. Our email address is info, that's I-N-F-O, at safeplaceonrace.com. And if you'd like to call in with a comment or a question, you can call 1-866-472-5788. Well, I'm delighted that we're going to have another great show to bring you today. And you already know that we were born into part of a story, but that we don't know the rest of the story and that we are in the process of digging our way out of this ditch we were born in called racism. And that every day tension grows, but we have a place to help work that out. Well, today's show is titled Racial Healing: How Talking About Race Helps Children. This is our first show about that. And you know, the heart of the W.K. Kellogg Foundation's mission is to support children, families, and communities, and to strengthen and create conditions that propel vulnerable children to success. And that too often the conditions or environments that promote the development of kids get put up on the back burner, and that there are barriers to their success. Well, the foundation did launch a long-term effort to put structural inequities behind us by putting it squarely in front of us. And our guest today is Dr. Gail Christopher, who is the Vice President for Program Strategy at the Kellogg Foundation in Battle Creek. And she serves on the executive team that provides overall direction and leadership for the foundation. Now, you may already know that Gail is a nationally recognized leader in health policy and has many years of experience in that area. And also that Gail is the author or co-author of 3 books. And that she does a monthly column in the Federal Times and has been quoted in such venerable institutions as the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, and on and on and on, at Essence Magazine, and been on Good Morning America, the Oprah Winfrey Show, and National Public Radio, and on and on and on. Dr. Christopher, we're delighted that you took time to join us. Hi.
Hi. It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're more than welcome. Well, you know, this topic for us today is one that certainly has our attention, especially as it relates to helping children. And before we get into more of the details about what the Kellogg Foundation is doing in that arena, I think our listening audience would like to know a little bit more about you and why are you so dedicated and committed to this work, Dr. Christopher?
You know, I was thinking about that in preparation for this conversation, and I'll share with you 2 stories that had a dramatic impact on my understanding. I grew up during, you know, the 60s, and where the Martin Luther King was a leader, and, you know, you sort of were in that world of civil rights and change. Mm-hmm. But on a personal level, I remember going off to a wonderful summer encampment in Chautauqua, New York. It was an arts camp, and I had the honor of actually meeting Paul Robeson. But it was my first time away from home for the summer, and I had a roommate. And my roommate was from the same town, and we shared a room, and we got along wonderfully. And then toward the end of the summer, I came home. We lived in houses, you know, not dorms per se, but I remember coming home. It was a Victorian house, and I came home, and there was an ambulance in front of the house. And so I asked what was going on, and they brought my roommate out on a stretcher. And I said, what happened? What happened? And the house parent shared a note with me that she had written. Apparently, she had attempted suicide. And the reason she gave for wanting to attempt suicide was that she did not want to go home to her family, particularly to her father, who had taught her to hate black people, had taught her all sorts of horrible things about black people, and that her experience of sharing a room with me during the summer had shown her that those were all lies. And so she couldn't grapple with the contradiction. And it happened that her father was a police officer in Cleveland as well. So I just remember that experience, and I can't help but say to myself, you know, and even then, you know, what manner of contradictions and lies are we living with in our society that could do that to the psyche of a child?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that story is one that wants to make me cry, you know, to think that a child would be so distraught about finding out the truth that she thought that there was no way out but to kill herself.
Well, and there are probably many more dynamics behind that story, but it was one of my first exposures to the extremes of this issue. I had others that helped to shape my perspective, as many people of color do, in terms of having lost loved ones through what appeared to be racially motivated violence. But they all helped to cement in my mind a determination to do something about this. And I think those have been guiding factors. One of my cousins was shot and killed, and the person who did it went off to the Marine Corps the next day without being charged. Mm-hmm. And in any way, there wasn't an inquiry or anything. So I remember as a child trying to figure out, why did these types of injustices happen? What was going on in the world? That was part of what shaped my thinking.
Well, my goodness, Dr. Christopher, and here you are working lovingly and committed to this work without malice. I think that that's a whole book that you might consider writing on its own. And I know that others have had experiences as well, but you are dedicated to the healing of racism as opposed to being anti and against other members of the human family. What a wonderful story and outcome that is out of this.
You're right. My focus is on healing. Our focus is on healing, on recognizing the ultimate connection between all human beings, that we are one human family. Mm-hmm. I think out of suffering sometimes comes the resolve to overcome suffering and mm-hmm. to put an end to suffering. My background and practice as a holistic doctor, my commitment, you know, the oath I took years ago was to do no harm. And so for me, the idea of healing, it just is a natural. And I recognized early in my career that so much of the suffering and even premature death that is experienced disproportionately in our country, the disparities, they are indirectly and directly related to this legacy of devaluing human beings based on physical characteristics. Mm-hmm. And it shows up in school systems and housing segregation and disparities in the criminal justice system. But ultimately, it's the belief that somehow some people have more value than others.
Can you tell us a little bit more about this belief, or is it a system of beliefs?
It is, and I think that's part of the work that we have to do in healing. It was an aha moment for me. I sort of had the innocence of a child, and I kept saying, why? Why are people so cruel? Why do these injustices happen? Why am I not assumed to be an equal human being? And when I became aware of the fact that there really was this belief system in play that has been in play for centuries, and it grew up in a time when they called it the era of enlightenment, but human beings were trying to make sense of the world from an ontological perspective, from a philosophical perspective. People were just trying to get it all together. And one of the great scientists of the times in his century was Linnaeus, And he categorized everything. He gave us many of the biological systems of categorization that still exist today. But in that, he also decided to categorize human beings and based on geography. But in addition to being based on geography in terms of geography of origin, he also categorized them and gave temperament and character classifications as well. So certain people were of a higher character and better temperament than others. And he had four groups of people. Because he was such a well-respected scientist, the philosophers of his era, one of the most well-respected, Immanuel Kant, he came along and said, you know, you're right, you're absolutely right about these categories of human beings, but clearly the humanity has reached its peak in the European or white race of people. And so this idea of racial stratification and racial hierarchy, it was grounded in both science and philosophy and certainly reinforced by religion. And it just gave permission for all manner of absurdity in terms of understanding humanity. We know enough now, biology, the genome, and other research really lifts up the absurdity of those belief system and the idea of categorizing people based on physical characteristics. But that belief system is still embedded. It's embedded in all of our disciplines and systems of knowledge. And so we have to do some work to undo that. It's just not going to dissipate on its own.
Well, that kind of embedding and encoding that way, it almost seems like it's an invisible secret somehow that's at times hard to see, and that we're all trained in it somehow.
I agree with that. It is not so secret in the sense that for those who experience it, I often say to groups, if you're at the top of that hierarchy, you know, it's invisible to you. If you're at the bottom of it, it's very visible to you. And the source of a great deal of pain and suffering. And so, but it is not spoken about, it is not called out for the absurdity, that it is. And our children in particular grow up being exposed to stereotypes and images and reduced and lowered expectations of their performance and being entrapped in impoverished communities. And they don't know that the backdrop for much of this would be structural inequities that grew out of a protracted adherence to this false belief system. It's important for them to be guided to understand that so that they don't self-identify with that false belief system and they don't let anyone else do that. I remember, if I could share a story, when I was raising my own children, my daughter had a school teacher that asked her to do a project, and she was so excited because the project was on Martin Luther King, and she just went overboard and overdid it, right? And the teacher kind of threw the paper back at her. I think she might have been 8 or 9 at the time, and said, you didn't follow instructions, so you get an F.
Oh,
and
my gosh. So
she came home and the teacher said she had to redo it. And she told me, she said, I refused to redo it because the teacher didn't read it. And I said, well, honey, it's the teacher, and, you know, you don't want to be disrespectful and blah, blah, blah. But even at the age of 8, she said, no, that is insulting to me. I won't take that. So she went back up, and the next day the teacher apologized, had taken the time to read the paper, given her an A, and apologized to her. And I had to chuckle to myself and say, I must have done something right, because she had the self-esteem in that moment of confrontation to stand her ground. She knew she'd done excellent work, and she wasn't going to be diminished in that way, even as a child. And we have to give our daughters and sons and children the inner strength to know who they are so that they can withstand this period that we're in, this period, I call it a period of transition. You know, we're not there yet, and our kids are still being exposed to the residue, if you will, of this belief system.
Well, I tell you, I know that we're not there yet. We're going to go to break and come back with Dr. Gail Christopher for some more very important information on racial healing. We'll be right back.
Hey.
Ask the experts. Call toll-free right now, 1-866-472-5787.
Hello?
And ask our all-star team to answer your question. That's 1-866-472-5787.
Thank you for calling.
VoiceAmerica.com.
Many people are seeking to make a difference in the world, but few actually have the tools to do so. Every week, host Mary Beth Lodge and her guests will have you thinking forward and will give you the tips to keep your life, goals, priorities, and choices on track. The result is an easier, happier, and more inspired life. The name of the program is What Matters. Tune in every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Eastern Time, 6 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. What really matters is the positive changes that you'll bring to your life and the world just by listening. What does the new health care law mean to you? Why is the country facing a deepening deficit? Can it be reversed? If education is important to fund, shouldn't we insist on seeing results? Do we have a workable energy policy? Who's calling the shots? Tune in to In the Public Interest with host Mike Hudson. We'll cover public policy, everything from taxes and spending to health care and other threatened entitlements. If it's in the public interest, it's in your interest to know. In the Public Interest can be heard live every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, 4 p.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
Stimulating talk.
It gets those synapses in the brain firing really fast.
All the time. The number one internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com. You are tuned in to A Safe Place to Talk About Race with your host, Sharon E. Davis. We know you have something to say, so participate in today's discussion by calling 1-866-472-5788. That's 1-866-472-5788. Or send us an email to Sharon at safeplaceonrace.com. Now, back to the program.
I'm very happy that we're with our guest today, Dr. Gail Christopher, who's Vice President for Program Strategy at the Kellogg Foundation. That's the WK Kellogg Foundation. Well, Gail, before we left for break, you were really sharing a lot of excellent information about the belief system and children and child-rearing practices and how that's affected you on a personal level. Well, Dr. Christopher, you've had an illustrious career and still have an illustrious career. Can you tell our listening audience a little bit more about how this has evolved over periods of time for you?
I'd be happy to. You know, back in the 60s, we were all a little more conscious about racial identity. It was that, you know, Black and I'm Proud era. Uh-huh. And that was the era in which I came of age and started my career. And I'll never forget, I read a book called The Textbook of Black Diseases, and I just couldn't get, I was just shocked by it. And what it was the first attempt by a medical doctor to really create a textbook that dealt with the health disparities, but it was titled Black Diseases at the time, and I became aware at that point of the extreme disparities in health outcomes and began to work with communities to try and get them to be more conscious about self-care and health and diet and fitness and exercise, and to take control, if they could, over their own health and well-being. And I soon realized that many of the people who needed that advice couldn't afford it. And so I then would contract with social service agencies within communities, Title 20 child care and programs that were serving children with disabilities, trying to be able to deliver that information to them without them having to pay directly, because there weren't any reimbursements for that kind of health education and wellness instruction at the time. And that evolved to consulting and designing social programs. And the one that was most, I always knew the role that racism was playing in all of this, and so I had an opportunity to co-develop a set of curriculum materials for classroom teachers back in the 70s and through the 80s, where we actually brought together a team of experts from multiple racial and ethnic perspectives. We had Mexican and Asian and Native American and European American and African American and immigrants of all races tell their stories in this historic curriculum so that teachers could you know, step away from the textbook and actually have a set of tools to begin to teach history from multiple perspectives. Mm-hmm. And I learned that when you engaged people in that storytelling, in this case it was more didactic and narrative, they still were seeing the world from multiple perspectives. And somehow that multiple perspective process actually was healing. And people felt it was safe to suddenly talk about all these things that were never discussed, right? Now,
right.
In that curriculum, we weren't dealing directly with racism, but it was there by innuendo in the sense of if you told the story of Asian immigrants and immigrants from the Philippines, throughout that story, you hear about the racism and the discrimination they were exposed to. You hear about the discrimination and the racism that the Hawaiian people were exposed to, the indigenous people, the Native Americans, the African Americans, the African American immigrants that came through Ellis Island. Mm-hmm. Many came through Ellis Island, but they were still subjected to that same shadow of discrimination based on physical characteristics. So that was a wonderful period of about 10 years of working, and I really had, I learned that it is possible to change people's perceptions and attitudes and beliefs through that experience. I saw teachers just become transformed in their own understanding of their own biases and their willingness to work with students in a different way through that process.
So they were able to heal through it enough to know the truth.
And to correct themselves, to self-correct in terms of how they managed their classrooms. Now we had all sorts of, it was sort of like the history was the Trojan horse and inside that we packed in all sorts of the best at the time of experiential learning and cooperative education and all sorts of tools around the student self-esteem and the student self-perception, stress management. You know, we buried all that inside this basic social studies curriculum. And we really, you know, it was endorsed by every leading education organization, elementary, secondary, middle school principals. The program was called Americans All. And it was in thousands of school systems around the country. And while it was a wonderful gift to be able to do it, I learned and had my belief in humanity reinforced through the process because I recognized it was possible for people to change.
That in itself, you know, I think needs to be said again, Gail, that you saw firsthand that it is possible. This is doable.
It is doable. So much of it is about story. It's about information. It's about awareness. And we have a continuum of development, we think, along this multicultural and racial healing continuum. And a first phase of it is moving past denial, moving into awareness of what, you know, the reality of this experience in certainly in America and certainly in the world and the cost and the consequences of it. I often say denial has four phases. The first phase is denial of fact and then people will face the fact, but they refuse to deal with the consequences. So sometimes you get people to where they, okay, I'll face the consequences. But then you get to a deeper level, which is the implications of those consequences. You know, let's just take smoking, for instance. People will say, okay, I smoke. Yeah, I'm going to die of something. You know, and they say, well, yeah, it might kill me. But what are the implications of that? What does that mean to your family? What does that mean to your community? You know, what does that mean in terms of how you're going to die if you keep smoking? There are a lot of implications of that consequence. And then ultimately, though, the final layer of denial is, you know, what are the feelings that are there that are in the way of the necessary change? And I think to digress or go back to the racial healing work, ultimately you have to get to the feelings that undergird all of this stuff that we've all been carrying around. And those feelings are sometimes frightening. You know, they're feelings of fear, they're feelings of guilt, they're feelings of shame. They're often feelings of anger, feelings of injustice, you know, and pain. But the skilled facilitator of racial healing work creates an environment in which it's okay to go to move through that continuum and get to the ultimate feeling that we need to get to, which is the feeling of love that comes from the release and the relief of these absurd beliefs.
Well, I tell you, Dr. Christopher, I would really like you to continue on with your career and in terms of how you continue to do this work today. We have a caller that's holding,
sure.
and And I would like to ask you, though, if you could take another couple of minutes to share about your continued unfoldment in racial healing in your career.
Well, so you kind of went from practitioner to designing social programs, but it became clear to me that so much of what determines the distribution of resources within communities, what determines the perpetuation of the structural inequities has to do with public policy mm-hmm. at the state level, at the city level, at the county level, you know, whether there's going to be child care facilities, whether those child care facilities are going to be able to feed lunch to children, you know, a lot of that has to do with our policies and structures. So my career took me to Washington, D.C., to working with the National Academy of Public Administration and the Alliance for Redesigning Government so that, you know, there would be a voice at that table during that movement, that was during the Clinton era, that could speak up for the communities that might be redesigned or realigned out of the government's purview, you know. And so it evolved to public policy work, but always guided by a deep understanding of the life and death consequences of these decisions, the life and death consequences, if not in the short run, in the long run, in terms of the impact of a teacher's interaction in the classroom or a doctor's interaction in the hospital or a social worker's interaction. You know, these things have consequences. So I evolved, you know, my career moved to working in the policy arena. Mm-hmm. And I went to Harvard and was the director of the Institute for Government Innovation there because oftentimes, although I know today it's very popular to describe government as the problem, some of our best solutions to many of our public challenges have come from a strong and creative public sector. Not always the elected public sector leader. Quite often it's the career public servant, the director of HHS or the director of the Public Works Department or the person in the criminal justice system who comes up with an idea that can affect the lives of hundreds of thousands. So working on innovative solutions that come from and through the public sector was very exciting and gratifying for me. And then after that, I led the Health Policy Institute at the Joint Center in Washington, D.C., and then I found myself back here at the Kellogg Foundation. So it's been an interesting, circuitous route, but always about change and systems of change that would help to heal people.
Well, you know, along those lines, this is not a simple process to be able to help figure out and dismantle structural problems. And so what you've done is really, and this is important, I think, for our listeners to know, you just didn't step in one day and say, I want to participate in this. You really have a commitment to it, and also the evolution of your career points to it. And I think that's the message for our listeners out there. Well, let's see if we can get in the first question of the day from Catherine from New York. Welcome to the show, Catherine.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be here. I'm actually a physician in training. I'm a writer and storyteller and an advocate for health, and I'm gaining so much from the conversation that's happened so far. My question really relates to the growing diversity that's taking place across our country and the ample opportunity that creates to talk with each other, both among ourselves and with others who are not like us. But I wanted some more insights as to ways in which we can have positive conversation and sort of demystify what we don't know about each other to find common ground. I was wondering, how do we get at sort of clearing up biases as young people and trying to engage each other in the workplace or on the playground? So I just wanted to know if there were particular books you recommended, or like you said, I was listening earlier when you were saying it's not that simple. It's kind of complicated. So just wanted some insights.
Well, that's a very good area. Yes, Dr. Christopher, we have about 30 seconds before break.
Well, I would recommend a wonderful book called The Racial Conditioning of Our Children by Nathan Rustein, mm-hmm. In terms of a backdrop. But basically, we can talk more, but creating safe spaces, small groups, whether it's the teachers in a school or the doctors in a hospital, to begin to build the trust and to listen and to hear each other's stories, to set a regular time for that. Some people consider that soft work, but it's real work to begin to build relationships of trust. And once some people, I've heard the expression, an enemy is someone whose story you haven't heard. And once you begin to, and I think those groups have to be diverse by design, and you have to have certain ground rules for those conversations. But once you start peeling back the human experience in those kinds of settings, you see and feel the commonality, even though there might be people from seven different backgrounds in the room. And it helps to lift up our common humanity. And those experiences give you a lot more courage and determination to do that again and again and again.
Oh, thank you so much, Catherine from New York, and we will be right back.
Talk, talk, talk. That's all we do is talk.
Yeah!
If you'd like to talk, call us toll-free right now at 1-866-472-5787. 1-866-472-5787.
That's it.
VoiceAmerica.com. These days, everyone is looking for information on staying young, healthy, and fit. The Voice America Health and Wellness Network is here to help you on your quest to better health and a better you. We talk about everything from diet, fitness, and aging to substance abuse, personal growth, mental health, and much more. Learn from our experts who cover health and wellness from traditional and holistic perspectives. Tune in to the Voice America Health and Wellness Network. Healthy living starts here.
Each week, Jimmy Gould brings you the stories and the people that you want to hear about. Tune in to A Current Life to hear about the journey to success, how our guests became the people they are today, and the highs and lows they experienced along the way. Each hour will leave you inspired and entertained as Jimmy gets up close and personal with every week's guest and shares ideas you can identify with and apply to your own life. A Current Life with Jimmy Gould airs Fridays at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, noon Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
Listen for Trust Across America every week on the Voice America Variety Channel. Tune in as host Jordan Kimmel is joined by national experts in the fields of accounting, finance, organizational behavior, and sustainability, as well as companies that are applying strategies that are enabling them to be recognized as doing the right thing by the American Trust Awards. Your host, Jordan Kimmel, is himself a trusted professional with years of experience in applying strategies and consulting with today's leading firms. Trust Across America is heard Wednesdays at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific on Voice America Variety.
Streaming live, the leader in Internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com. You are tuned in to A Safe Place to Talk About Race with your host, Sharon E. Davis. We know you have something to say, so participate in today's discussion by calling 1-866-472-5788. That's 1-866-472-5788. Or send us an email to Sharon at safeplaceonrace.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back. I'm delighted that Dr. Gail Christopher, who's Vice President for Program Strategy at the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, has found time in her busy schedule to join us this hour. And we've had a lot of excellent information sharing that helps us very, very much. Well, Gail, we might have to kind of turn our attention a bit to some of the other areas before the show closes. And One of those areas has to do with the heart of the Kellogg Foundation's mission to support children and families and launching into a long-term effort to put structural inequities behind us and putting them square in front of us, as it says. And it's known as America Healing, Strategies Toward Racial Equity. Can you tell us more about that?
Oh, I'm happy to do that. The board of directors of the W.K. Kellogg Foundation made a firm commitment to be the most effective anti-racist organization it could be, and that was before I was hired. And when I came on board, because of that commitment largely, I felt if the largest, one of the largest philanthropies, you know, in the world was making such a commitment, sign me up. You know, I wanted to be part of it. But my own belief system is firm in that we have to really focus on what we're for, not what we're against, because the power of our minds is so strong to create something. We want to always be focused on the desired outcome. And so we were able to move from just being anti-racist, but to promoting racial equity, and then toward creating an initiative, a way of strategizing, well, how are you going to do what no one has ever done before? You know, how are you going to contribute to this unfinished business of our nation? Because we looked at the fact that our mission was to create the conditions that would propel vulnerable children to success, we knew one of those conditions would be addressing the legacy, the hidden and unseen shadow of the legacy of racism. And so it fit smack in the heart of our mission, especially when you consider that most of the children in this country being born today are children of color. And within a few decades, we will be a predominantly, as they would say, majority-minority nation, although that description is going to have to change.
So,
you know, this is our business. Our country needs to do this. We can't let most of the children in the country grow up in poverty or in low-income families, not if we're going to continue to be an economically viable nation. So that was the charge and the challenge. The way the program is designed, or the way the effort is designed, is we know we have to do two things simultaneously. We have to promote the kind of healing that we're talking about at the same time that we fund organizations that are out there dealing with what I call the symptoms of the inequities or the consequences, and that would be the structural realities of health disparities and poor education outcomes. Achievement gap is the term that's used, you know, in the field. Disparities in terms of criminal justice and incarceration, disparities in terms of birth outcomes. Those are some of the structural issues, and there are many different efforts to address those. But we believe that if you don't change the hearts of people, you'll never create the critical mass of leadership and commitment that's required for sustained change. So we funded both the structural efforts as well as the healing efforts around the country. We put out a request for proposal back in, I think it was 2009. We thought we'd get a couple of hundred responses to do some of this healing work that would lead to more structural work. We had almost 1,000 responses within less than 2 months. So clearly there's a desire in the world and in our nation to address this issue, and our work right now is to bring other funders into this work in a very direct, you know, it's one thing to do diversity work. You can do diversity work and never touch the issue of racism.
Right.
We're being very explicit about this belief system of racism and its undoing and its the healing of the consequences of it.
Well, I tell you, Dr. Christopher, once again, in a very short period of time, we could talk about what you've said for the next half hour and more just on that. And a couple of things that are standouts has to do with that you are in position to fund organizations, especially where it relates to structural disparities that, you know, that are here. So, and it's very courageous, it seems, for any foundation. I don't know of another, quite frankly, to do this work, or to at least, you know, have a strategy to do this work, and to also really act as a leader to get other foundations to participate. How tall an order is that? My gosh.
Well, we're not alone, and I want to be clear that the field of philanthropy is certainly moving in this direction more than it ever has before. The field has been more inclined to embrace the concept of diversity than it has, you know, a head-on approach to the issue of racism. But we've been at this in a very direct way now for almost 5 years, and we have seen a change. And there are many other foundations that are expressing an interest and a willingness to step up. Now, historically, most progressive foundations have dealt with the what I call the symptoms or the consequences of the structural inequities. You know, much of your anti-poverty funding, much of your food equity funding, you know, I could go on and on, housing equity, housing, you know, those are in a sense dealing with the structural consequences of the system, but it's important to deal with the undergirding and underlying beliefs that fuel the persistent structural inequities. So we're very proud and humbled at the same time that Kellogg is able to play a catalytic role, but we definitely want to feed that leadership role to a much broader universe of many, many funders from multiple sectors, private and otherwise, who recognize that this is the unfinished business, that we have to do this work if we're going to realize our potential as a nation.
Oh, my gosh. Well, in essence, it seems sometimes that these symptoms and are like trying to stop the hemorrhaging a bit, you know.
If
someone is hemorrhaging, the house, you know, the health care, the inequities and crime, all that kind of thing, you know, you're going to put something on it just to stop the blood flow, quite frankly, from getting bigger. But that doesn't, as you so eloquently stated, that doesn't cure or solve the problem. And that seems to be the focus of the foundation in terms of being up front and out with looking at the root causes and addressing that as much as humanly possible.
We do, and I don't want to make it seem simplistic in the sense that when you will change people's perceptions, when people see the cause of the problem in a different light, you know, they will, I believe, draw upon their creative abilities to come up with different solutions.
Right.
It's as simple as the atmosphere that's set up in the classrooms between the teachers and the students. Is it an atmosphere that is asset-focused, that affirms the innate ability of a student, or is it an environment that makes the student feel less able to succeed? The quality of that interaction, the nature of that dynamic will affect outcomes. The same is true with decisions. We know that doctors on an unconscious level make decisions about, you know, medical decisions in terms of who gets what treatment. That there's just a panoply of studies that show that there's a disparity in the treatment that people are given. And we think some of those disparities are driven by unconscious biases where those who come into the professions, you know, are the product of their upbringing. And if they've been taught certain things about certain groups of people, they project those beliefs into their clinical interactions.
So in this regard, you're not just stating an opinion for those who may have joined us in the last few minutes here. This, the information that you're sharing is based on studies and facts about looking at the data.
Oh, absolutely. The Institute of Medicine report Unequal Treatment documented hundreds of studies that have proven that there is disparity in treatment. And we have the work of Dr. David Williams, which documents the unconscious nature of that in terms, even something as fundamental as the pain, the amount of painkiller that's given when a bone is broken. There's an amazing study that was done both in California and in Atlanta that showed that there was a great disparity in the doctor's prescriptions for painkillers based by race, ethnicity, whether they were Latino or African American, and the doctors in this case were white. And the only thing that you can attribute this disparity in treatment, we believe, is to the unconscious biases that they bring. So you have to engage physicians early on in their training, make them aware that that's maybe how they've, you know, been trained to think, as it were, and therefore they have to put in place certain safeguards to mitigate that training. We know of one judge who, when he became aware of his own unconscious biases through the implicit bias test that you can take, by the way, you can Google implicit bias and take the test, he realized that the pictures of the people that were coming before him were causing him to make more biased decisions toward darker-skinned juveniles. And so when he took the pictures off the case files, he found that he was making more equal decisions. There was an opportunity for more equal justice. So this stream of bias that runs through us, you know, is often unconscious.
Well, you know, in a way, it's good to know that. And in another way, it sounds very scary.
It is. It is very scary in the sense of the magnitude of the implications of the challenge we face as communities, as a nation. We really do have to deal with this, I believe, for the sake of our children and for the sake of our future.
Well, I'm sure we do. And we'll go to break, and we'll be right back with Dr. Gail Christopher from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation.
Talk, talk, talk. That's all we do is talk.
Yeah!
If you'd like to talk, call us toll-free right now at 1-866-472-5787. 1-866-472-5787.
That's it.
VoiceAmerica.com.
Ever wondered what private investigators really do and how they go about solving cases? Each week, PIs Declassified gives a glimpse into this little-known world. Join your host, Francie Kaler, a noted private investigator, in conversations with detectives and experts in the field. False confessions, forensic evidence, finding missing persons, exposing fraud, exonerating the innocent. All areas that Francie and her guests will cover. And have they got stories to tell? Tune in and call in to the live show Thursdays at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern, on Voice America Variety.
The Internet's number one talk station.
Number one talk station.
VoiceAmerica.com.
You are tuned in to A Safe Place to Talk About Race with your host, Sharon E. Davis. We know you have something to say, so participate in today's discussion by calling 1-866-472-5788. That's 1-866-472-5788. Or send us an email to Sharon at safeplaceonrace.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back. We're with Dr. Gail Christopher, who's Vice President for Program Strategy at the W.K. Kellogg Foundation. And, Gail, you've just really had such information that we need another hour to go over. We do have another caller, and maybe we could get to this question before the show ends and then follow up with other questions that have come in from emails and the like. Welcome to the show, Sharon from New York.
Yes. My name is Sharon Morgan. And I know Dr. Christopher, and I actually don't have a question. I wanted to just call and compliment her on the work that she's doing. She's provided support to racial reconciliation projects that I've been involved in, and there's absolutely no doubt about the need for structural change, and I'm just proud to know her and to know and be involved in the work that she's doing with Kellogg. So I just called to give her kudos.
Well, thank you, Sharon, for your call, and you all have done some wonderful work. You ought to just mention the coming to the table and the reconciliation between these different families a little bit, maybe.
We're matching the descendants of people who were enslaved with the descendants of the families who enslaved them. And it is an ongoing effort to use that knowledge, making those linkages in order for people to heal. And we've written a book called Gather at the Table, which is an example of how this linkage can work. So I and a writer named Thomas DeWolf went on a journey around the country visiting ancestral locations and using that as material to be able to achieve reconciliation. And we're offering a model for other people to be able to use that for individual healing as well as community healing.
Well, that's just wonderful. Thank you so much, Sharon from New York, for calling in.
And thank you. And thank you, Dr. Christopher.
You're all welcome. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. Well, we also had some people who sent in some questions, and maybe we'll have a time to address as many of them as we can.
Okay.
This is from a Lorraine in Michigan, and her question is, what data are you using to support the need to be involved? If the status of children is not improved, what else are you going to do?
Well, we certainly use all the demographic and data that's available about outcomes in all of the disciplines, be it education, health, criminal justice, child welfare, you know, our grantees, and of course our own learning and innovation, we definitely use the data systems, which are just too abundant right now. There are some challenges in that you have to disaggregate that data down to very local levels, so you have to use some new strategies for gathering data, you know, that are different. But we base our work and our funding and all of our grantees, you know, they present the data in their communities. Your question in terms of what are we going to do if things don't change, we'll change our strategies. But we have enough evidence, I think, to date where there are some examples of improved outcomes, whether it's infant mortality or student success or student achievement or even obesity reduction, childhood obesity reduction, greater access to healthy foods. We do see people who come up with innovative strategies and they do get results. The biggest challenge is taking that to scale so that some of these innovations become practice on a larger scale or policies that promote good practices.
Well, this won't happen overnight, will it? It
no, won't be that's overnight. The other thing, yeah.
Well, we also have a question that came in from a John from Washington, D.C. that's kind of related, and his question is, what does your organization do to prepare children to continue the work of racial healing?
Well, you know, we're a foundation, so we fund people out there who do work with children directly. We don't do the work, so I need to make that clear. Mm-hmm. But we are always inspired by everything from people who are publishing new books that give diverse images and tell healing stories through the, instead of, you know, the usual fairy tales, you know, or the usual children's books. They're
right.
Writing new books that capture these new stories, that capture these real life experiences of diverse children. We're working with pediatricians, dentists and dental therapists and, social workers. We're funding very creative projects that are giving young people the tools and the skills they need to connect to their humanity and to their ultimate value as human beings. We work with parents. Parent education is a major part of the work. We funded some very exciting projects that help parents to not only work differently with their own children, but to become more civically engaged so they can make the help to guide decisions that determine the resource allocations within their communities.
Well, you know, Dr. Christopher, out of maybe the 7 questions that we could talk about that are still open here, where callers have called in or even emailed in, many of them relate to what you're just talking about. And if I could just give kind of like a thumbnail overview of some of these questions, if I've missed something, maybe you could speak to that.
Okay.
Because some of these questions are, I've noticed that more and more kids in kindergarten and younger are differentiating people based on color and often in a negative way. What kind of things are they learning and how to hold the kids off from forming prejudices? That's one. And then it goes on, preschools and daycares and private home providers. Is there a way to address that? And another one, this is from an Aziz Bey. The first part of his question is, you know, what do you talk about to the children on the subject of race? Would you like to speak to any of those a little further?
Well, I would in a very general sense. You know, so much of our perceptions about others comes through the media, particularly when we live as we do in such segregated areas. So we form these stereotypes. We are bombarded with stereotypical images, even in the cartoons. You know, not just in the sitcoms and the others, but even in the cartoons, there's this perpetuation of the stereotypes. And so we are funding a lot of media projects to try and help raise awareness and change behaviors and change images that are being projected through the media. We also are funding people, again, who are working with the parents, because as that story I told from my own childhood, that young woman's ideas about others was shaped by the stories she heard in her own family. And so it's very important to work with young parents and would-be parents so that they can begin to send different messages to children. And what is that message? That message is about our connectedness as one human family. That we are we are 99.9% the same. And the differences that are there are to be celebrated and valued and understood, because all differences serve a purpose. And those purposes are not negative. Those purposes are positive, and they are a reflection of the brilliance of nature and the human nature, as well as all aspects of nature. So we have to, you know, just be grounded in this deep understanding that we are truly connected on a spiritual level as one human family.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. Well, I think that we could talk another half hour on that as well. You know, I think that you've covered so many of the areas already from the questions. There is another direction, but I think you've already answered that. And this is from a Mary in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And how far will the Kellogg Foundation go? And I think behind that is that change your strategy and keep going. Or is the Kellogg Foundation going to stop this work in the anytime soon?
I think the board of directors of the foundation is to be applauded. They are, as one might say, all in the sense of this is a firm commitment that the board has made, and they set the direction for the foundation. And they understand that it is a long-term work, that it isn't going to happen overnight. But they're equally as committed to moving and leveraging and bringing in other funders to creating what we call a global fund that will enable us to perpetuate or to have this work continue in perpetuity as long as it's needed. So this is a time for us to shift our energy and our focus to bringing others to this work, so that we couldn't fund all the applications that came in to do this work. We simply didn't have enough resources. So we understand that our role is a catalytic role to bring other funders, and we anticipate success in that effort in the short run, not the long run.
Well, you mentioned global and bringing in others. That just seems to be such a huge and courageous thing to do today. Gail, you won't believe it, but we have approximately 45 seconds left today. So if you could, is there any one statement that you would like to close with that you would like our listening audience to know about?
The global significance, you know, the institution of the enslavement of people based on physical characteristics was a global phenomenon that lasted for multiple centuries. And undergirding the permission to do that was this absolutely backwards belief in human hierarchy based on physical characteristics. So the scale and the scope of the problem is global, and it will take, I believe, very concentrated and focused efforts within many, many countries
Thank you so much, Dr. Gail Christopher, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you again for listening today. Please join host Sharon E. Davis for another edition of A Safe Place to Talk About Race next Monday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. We'll talk then.